This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
I wanted a girl, or should I say, she wanted me. Show me her room, isn't it good? Norwegian wood. She asked me to stay and she told me to sit anywhere. So I looked around and I noticed there wasn't a chair. I sat on the road, biding my time, drinking her wine.
BFM 89.9, welcome to Snap, Crackle and Pop, a show dedicated to dissecting pop music. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Today the focus is on cultural appropriation, which is a complex, difficult topic to talk about, but I'll do my best. I wanted to open with the Beatles and Norwegian Wood because that landmark musical moment, the first time a sitar was played as part of a Western song arrangement, hits so many of the points that I wanted to explore today. Number one, it definitely is an act of appropriation, taking the sitar, something deeply embedded in another culture, and including it in a mainstream money-making song in the West. But then crucially, number two, appropriation isn't always a negative act. Here, it was done with real respect and reverence, with George Harrison committed to learning from Ravi Shankar himself. And finally, number three, the song is just good. And if you're going to appropriate, it works best when the result is something that actually sounds like growth. This was the beginning of the sitar and Indian classical music making inroads into the world's collective consciousness, and its cultural influence was immediately felt. While on the subject of rock and roll and appropriation, we have to talk about Elvis. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. The music of the King of Rock and Roll borrowed fully from gospel, country, and rhythm and blues. But it's his legacy of borrowing from black culture that continues to be discussed, not least in the context of other white artists, such as Eminem, who have come along and made a name for themselves in historically black genres.
May I have your attention, please? May I have your attention, please? Will the real Slim Shady please stand up? I repeat, will the real Slim Shady please stand up? We're gonna have a problem here.
He may be venerated now, but in his day, Elvis, with his hips and his sneer, was famously no stranger to controversy.
It's shocking. I watched him gyrate his legs and swivel his hips. And our parent teacher's group feels he should not be on television.
Many white disc jockeys refused to play Elvis on the grounds that it was black music, while many African-American DJs refused to play a white man. It was a strange spot to occupy. Some artists considered him an interloper, taking the best parts of black music while also benefiting from the color of his skin. But other musicians, like Bobby Womack and Little Richard, regarded him as an amplifier.
It was like an earthquake in my neighborhood. The whole place was shaking when he came up. And I said, how did a person possess that kind of power that it even comes off the TV and grabbed me in this ghetto neighborhood?
Elvis took my Tutti Frutti, and I was very disgusted. But by him saying it, he really made it bigger and made me bigger.
During those days, if it was a white artist doing something, they would just say, they don't like our blacks and we don't like them either. He's nothing but a copycat. But Elvis Presley, when he came on, chicks were screaming and going crazy, and it was just like any other neighborhood. And I said, this guy's got something going, man.
Elvis had something that made him sound like he truly meant it, and that's what made a lot of people like myself like him.
Elvis himself was always open about his influences and about giving due respect to the artists who came before him. And that love of the music and power of the songs he was covering could be heard in The Sun Sessions, his very first. Here he is, Elvis Presley, with his breakthrough release covering Arthur Crittup's That's All Right, BFM 89.9.
Frustrated Minds, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to Snap, Crackle and Pop, a show dedicated to examining pop music. Today we're discussing cultural appropriation. Earlier we heard the Beatles and Elvis, two examples of appropriation that amplified and expanded music. But now for some artists who haven't done so well in this space.
Oh, I'm a doctor to take a picture so I can look at you from inside as well. Turning up and turning down, I'm turning in, I'm turning red, I'm turning Japanese, I think I'm turning Japanese, I really think so.
Japan has always been a magnet for people and pop stars looking for aesthetic and stylistic inspiration, and one artist took that way too far. When Gwen Stefani emerged as a solo artist in 2004, she did it accompanied by four mute Japanese women dressed in schoolgirl outfits, dancing around her. As she mentioned, she even named them. And while that was 14 whole years ago, it didn't stop there. She's capitalized on this Japanese culture grab, expanding it to a clothing and fragrance line, even a children's show.
Hey guys, Gwen here. Get ready to meet Love, Angel, Music, Baby, and G in the Cuckoo Harajuku Breakdown.
Matt TV perhaps summed it up best.
Green tea and my small bonsai tree, and any movie that is made by Ang Lee and my hybrid car that gets 35 MPG.
I love the Asian race. They're the smartest people in the world. Even though they give up newborn girls, they invented sake and chicken teriyaki. So I'm asking now, aren't Asians great?
Margaret Cho, an American comedian of Korean heritage, also addressed this at the time, likening the Harajuku girls to a minstrel show and blackface. And in 2018, with new lenses to view this project, and Gwen Stefani refusing to apologize for paying this quote-unquote compliment to Japan, this next song hasn't aged well. Here's Gwen Stefani with Harajuku Girls, BFM 89.9.
Just wait till you get your little hands on L.A. and B.
Hello, this is Snap, Crackle and Pop, a show that takes a closer look at pop music. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Today we're looking at cultural appropriation. Before the break, we heard Gwen Stefani singing about her Harajuku girls. This accusation of cultural appropriation, at least to me, feels very cyclical. There's always some new outrage in pop culture news, though you think they'd learn. But perhaps that's the problem. Pop stars are learning that the shortcut for revamping or refreshing their image is to make themselves at home in another culture. For instance, at the MTV Video Music Awards in 2013, Miley Cyrus played a huge role in ushering this word into the mainstream.
If you thought twerking was something new, think again. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, the word twerk actually dates back to 1820, nearly 200 years before Miley Cyrus's famous MTV Video Music Awards performance. Back then, it was spelled T-W-I-R-K rather than T-W-E-R-K, but it had the same meaning. To dance in a, quote, sexually provocative manner using thrusting movements of the bottom and hips while in a low squatting stance. Twerk resurfaced in the early 20th century. Oxford says the current form of the verb came from the 1990s New Orleans bounce music scene.
So it's a dance that has its roots in black party culture. But also featured on stage were black dancers, really just functioning as props, all but obscured by giant teddy bears strapped on their backs. Taylor Swift has also come under fire for her video Shake It Off for much the same reasons. Both artists come from country roots, and the accusations were similar as well, that they could be cultural tourists, cherry-picking what would suit the evolution of their music without actually needing to engage in the roadblocks that black artists face. But for Miley, the issue goes beyond videos and stage performances. According to the Theron Brothers, writers of We Can't Stop, Miley had specifically asked for a song that would, in her words, sound black, which is a pretty telling request from someone who's now gone back to her country roots, a genre that is traditionally very white indeed. Here's that track. See if you can hear the influence. This is Miley Cyrus and We Can't Stop, BFM 89.9.
Dancing with my lead, doing whatever. house, we can love who we want to. It's our song, we can sing if we want to. It's my mouth, I can say what I want to.
BFM 89.9, Miley Cyrus, We Can't Stop. You're listening to Snap, Crackle and Pop, a show that's all about pop music. Today, we're covering the tricky terrain of cultural appropriation. The conversation about this tends to go this way. Something happens, someone is outraged, others join in, and then a coalition will form on the other side with people defending the act and eventually dismissing it as a simple case of hate is gonna hate. But this next song represents the very real-life effects that appropriating a song and culture can have.
In the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight. In the
That was the Tokens singing The Lion Sleeps Tonight in 1961. Solomon Linda, a South African musician who wrote and recorded the original Zulu version of that song, died in poverty a year later. So it's a complex story, but in essence, Solomon Linda's original recording from 1939 caught the attention of a band called The Weavers, who recorded a version of it, claimed royalties for the arrangement, and are responsible for the famous Wimowe, which is actually a misheard word. Solomon Linda himself didn't receive any royalties at first, before he was eventually sent $1,000 sometime before the definitive version by The Tokens came to be. To put that in perspective, journalist Rian Malin has estimated that for this little moment in The Lion King,
in the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight,
the song earned 15 million. While Solomon Linda's family have now reached a settlement with the holder of the song's rights, this whole thing is just fundamentally unfair. And in case you've never heard the original, this is Solomon Linda and Imbube on BFM 89.9.
We
BFM 89.9, this is Snap, Crackle and Pop, and that was Solomon Linda and Mbube. Today we're talking about cultural appropriation. Solomon Linda was from South Africa, and thankfully there's a happier example of a white artist being inspired by music from that country. Paul Simon wrote the album Graceland in Johannesburg after hearing a tape of South African street music and finding the people who made it. Recording during apartheid and amidst accusations of exploitation, it went on to become a hugely successful album and is close to being universally loved. Working with local Johannesburg musicians and touring after that with Ladysmith Black Mambazo, Paul Simon's Graceland represents how to work with a culture to create something beautiful and respectful. Before I play the song, just a quick note, join me next week for a show that's going to be all about the innovators and boundary pushers of pop music. Playing us out today, Paul Simon with Under African Skies, BFM 89.9.
Joseph's face was black as night, the pale yellow moon shone in his eyes. His path was marked by the stars in the southern hemisphere, and he walked his days under Africa's skies. This is the story of how we begin to remember. This is the powerful pulsing of love in the vein. After the dream of falling and calling your name out, these are the roots of rhythm, and the roots of rhythm remain.
and the pale yellow moon shone in his eyes. His path was marked by the stars of the southern hemisphere, and he walked the length of his days under African skies.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.